Well, good evening. Oh, you are half of you awake. Let's try that again. Good evening. Oh, that's more like it. Fantastic. Well, you had a Texan, and now you have a Brit. So we're multinational here this evening. Well, it's a real privilege to be back here again this evening. It was wonderful to see so many people out last night to hear Ravi and Mary Jo and I. And thank you for those of you who have come tonight as well for giving up another evening to be with us. Well, about a year or so ago, I was invited to speak at Queen's University in Kingston in Ontario, and they'd asked me to come and speak on the topic of Jesus among other gods. Nice, safe kind of topic. And it was a wonderful evening. We had about 450 people in the lecture theatre. Probably about half of them were non-Christians. Really good kind of turnout. So I did my my talk, and then we came to the time of Q&A. And the first person to the microphone asked this question. He looked at me from the microphone and he said, "What I want to know is why do Christians hate gays?" I remember sort of praying inwardly. I think I prayed, "Thank you, Jesus. Thank you, Lord. Thank you for making me a really easy first question." I sort of looked around for possible exits and there weren't any. And I thought, well, this will make great headlines. You know, Brits killed by mob in an angry student rebellion or something. So I kind of looked at the young man, and I began actually by apologizing. I said, well, the first thing I have to say is if anyone's given you, any Christian has given you the impression by what they've said that Christians hate gays, then I have to begin by apologizing, because that's not the Christian position. But I said, I wonder if, you know, as we try and unpack the issue that you've raised, the important issue you've raised, if perhaps I could begin by asking you a couple of questions to clarify. I said, if by why do Christians hate gays, do you mean why do Christians believe what we believe about homosexuality, that sexual activity belongs within the marriage between a man and a woman? Is that what you mean? And he went, yes, that's what I want to understand. I said, well, before I can answer that, I need to ask you a couple of other questions, if that's okay. I said, here's my first question for you. I said, do you believe that anything is absolutely right or wrong? He looked at me and he said, I want to say yes, but if I say yes, you're going to ask me how I know, aren't you? And I said, yeah. And I said, this isn't some kind of game. This is really important, because if right and wrong are actually real things that really exist, then we have to grapple with them rather than reinvent them to suit our own purposes. So that's a really important question. I'm kind of glad we're on the same page with that. But I said, there's another question I need to ask you as well before I push it a little bit further and tell you why Christians believe what we do about this issue. I said, have you looked into what some of the other major worldviews out there teach about this issue of homosexuality? He said, I'm not sure I know what you mean. I said, well, I'm a great believer in the maxim that comparison is the mother of clarity. I said, take Islam. For example, I've spent 25 years studying Islam. My academic work, my PhD is in Quranic studies. I said, if you look at what Islam has to say about this issue, then Sharia law is very clear. Death for those who are gay or lesbian. The only debate in Islamic law is how that killing should be carried out, whether it's by stoning or burying alive. That's what Islam has to say on that issue. I said, now, what about atheism? I said, actually, are you an atheist? He went, well, I guess I would probably self-describe that way. I said, what have you thought about what atheism has to say on this issue? He said, I've never really thought about it. I said, well, presumably, if atheism is true, I presume you subscribe to the idea that evolution explains everything, that everything we see in biology, from animal behavior to human behavior, can be explained by evolution, right? So therefore, there has to be an evolutionary explanation for homosexuality. He said, I guess there has to be. I said, well, it's interesting if you read the literature that actually biologists have a number of theories as to why homosexuality may have evolved and been selected for. One idea that many biologists have advanced is that homosexual behavior has evolved because it puts a check on population growth. If 10, 15% or whatever of a group of animals, including human beings, have same-sex attraction, there'll be less reproduction. If there's not enough food supply, then the population growth is reduced. And he said, yeah, I kind of see how that might work. I said, well, interestingly, I can actually point to an article in Huffington Post, the online newspaper, a couple of months ago by a gay activist arguing that this is true, that the world faces a population crisis, and therefore we need more gays and lesbians. He went, that makes sense. I said, does it really? I said, here is the problem. I said, my wife and I have two very good friends of ours in the UK, old friends of ours, who are lesbians. They are married, and they have two children by sperm donation from two gay friends of theirs. I said, do you now see what you've done? You've said that the reason that homosexual behavior evolved is to put a check on population growth. My good friends over here have gone out and had two children. They have subverted the very reason that good old Mother Nature selected for them. They are quite literally a waste of space on purely biological grounds. As I said those words, waste of space, you could hear go through the audience. And once again, I thought to myself, where are the exits? And I looked at my friend and I said this. I said, whatever the Christian worldview has to say to my gay and to my lesbian friends, it does not say they are a waste of space. In fact, if I heard anyone say that about my friends, there'd be a serious issue because they're my friends and I love them dearly. I said, Christianity does say that homosexual behavior represents human brokenness, but it says we are all broken, the heterosexual and the homosexual, and that brokenness will manifest itself in different ways. And the only way to deal with that brokenness is to come to Jesus Christ, who offers his arms open to accept each one of us where we are and then begin rebuilding us and renewing us and restoring us. And he welcomes in repentant heterosexuals as well as repentant homosexuals. And I actually got a round of applause from 450 people. No, you don't need to, but just told me that I was just glad to get out of there alive. Now, the reason I begin with that story is it illustrates, I think, something very important. I want to pick up an idea that Mary Jo introduced and unpack it to you for 20 minutes or so this evening. And that's the importance of questions. You see, I could have launched into my friend in that audience asking why do Christians hate gays by giving a clever and eloquent and hopefully sort of relatively coherent lecture on Christian sexual ethics, and it would probably have got me precisely nowhere, and I would probably have needed to run for the exits. But by engaging in a dialogue, by asking questions, well, it was a game changer, and it changed everything, because questions are incredibly powerful. You see, there are a number of things that questions do very, very well. In fact, four things that questions do very, very well, far more than a mere lecture. Four things that questions do very, very well. The first thing that I think questions do very, very well is they can expose motives or assumptions. You know, when somebody raises a question or an objection to Christianity, it can be helpful to know where they're coming from. Why are they asking it? What's their motivation? Or rather than assume that, we can ask them. We can use questions to dig into where our friend is coming from. Secondly, I think questions create a conversation. Mary Jo unpacked this brilliantly. So often I think we forget as Christians that the most powerful form of evangelism in existence is one any one of us can use. And it's simply called talking to people. And if we simply became better at having conversations and being natural as we talked about our faith with our friends and our neighbors and our colleagues, I think we would get so much further in conversations about what we really believe and really care about. Asking questions is a wonderful way to engage in starting conversations. Thirdly, I think asking questions forces the person you're talking to think. You know, it's very easy if you're a skeptic or an atheist or someone who's not a Christian to throw out objections that perhaps you've heard secondhand online or in the media. And if when you're a skeptic and you're talking to a Christian, if the Christian annoyingly turns around and asks questions back to you, it forces you to think. And many of our skeptical friends haven't thought through their skepticism. And learning to ask good questions can help them do so. And then lastly, and I like this one because I'm British and I'm naturally lazy, is that asking questions takes the pressure off you. If every time someone asks a question about your faith or raises an objection, you feel you have to give that 15-minute lecture, that is a heck of a lot of work. If you just sit there and smile at somebody and ask a question, they've now got to do the work, and you can be thinking of the next question, and the next question, and the next question. Anyone who has young children will know the power of just how long this can go on for, and how annoying it can become if you're not careful. Now, here's the interesting thing. What I'm describing to you here is, of course, thoroughly biblical. Thoroughly biblical, because Jesus did this all the time. I wonder if you've noticed, as you've read the Gospels, particularly how often Jesus does this. He's asked a question, somebody raises an issue, an objection to what he's saying, and rather than give a response or a lecture or a sermon, he uses a question. Have you noticed this? In fact, scholars will tell you that Jesus asks something like 300 questions in the Gospels if you go through and count them. And I want to give you two examples of this evening to show you how Jesus uses this technique of asking questions and does it brilliantly, and how I think we can learn from him and learn how we can apply this to the situation situations that we find ourselves in our families, in our neighborhoods, at work, at university, wherever you are most of your time. Let me start with a story from the Gospels that most of us are very familiar with, the story of Jesus and the rich young ruler. Let me read you this short encounter that's reported in several of the Gospels. I'm going to read to you from Mark chapter 10. Mark tells us, as Jesus started on his way, a man ran up to him, fell on his knees before him. "Good teacher," he asked, "what must I do to inherit eternal life?" "Why do you call me good?" Jesus replied. "No one is good except God alone." The story goes on, but we'll leave it there for a moment. I wonder how many of you, if you've read that story, and I presume many of you have, as you've read that story, have you ever found yourself thinking, what the heck is Jesus doing? It's okay to ask yourself that question sometimes. The Gospels are designed to make you ask questions. You see, I put it to you that if you were to go home from this event tonight, and at perhaps 11 o'clock at night, just before you turn in for the evening, there's a knock on your door, and you open your door, and it's your next-door neighbor. And they look at you, and they say, "Good Christian, what must I do to inherit eternal life?" I absolutely guarantee you are not going to use this answer. You're going to say, "Come to church on Sunday, and the pastor will tell you." Or some such thing. Why doesn't Jesus do this? Why doesn't he say, "Follow me, I'm the Son of God"? Why doesn't he say, "Come to the Alpha course that Peter, James, and John are running at the Sea of Galilee next Wednesday. There is loaves and fishes for everybody." None of these things. Why does he do this? Well, a thought for a moment. If you were to take your average non-Christian Canadian, think of a friend or a neighbor or a colleague or a classmate or a neighboring Baptist, and you would have say to them, grant me two things for a moment. Grant me that God exists and grant me that heaven exists. Don't argue about it. Let's just imagine for a moment that there is a God and there is a heaven. What do you think you need to do to get there? What is your friend probably going to reply? Any ideas? What do most people think you have to do to get to heaven? Thank you. Be good. Yeah, the most common religion, the most widely practiced religion in the world is good personism. And this is exactly what this rich young guy is saying to Jesus. He's basically saying, "You look like a good moral teacher, so you're a good person, so you're clearly going to heaven, so how do I get there?" This is the whole kind of theological mess that Jesus has to untangle. Now, he could give a clever sermon or a lecture or pass a copy of Wayne Grudem off the shelf, but he doesn't do this. Instead, Jesus uses this brilliant answer. By what he basically says in this question that he uses, Jesus basically says to this rich young man, "You know what? You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. Only good people are going to heaven. But there's a problem. Only God is good. So now you follow the argument. Only good people are going to heaven. All good people are going to heaven. Only God is good. So who gets to go? Only God. And I'm afraid your application to join the Trinity has been turned down this morning." And of course, that then opens up a much broader question. And of course, as you read on in Mark chapter 10, you discover the next issue comes out, that this young man's real problem is not actually morality, it's actually money, and the way that he's idolized money and riches and power. But you see, by that one question, that one penetrating question, "Why do you call me good?" Jesus turns the entire conversation in a different direction. Questions can expose motives, reveal assumptions, powerful things. A good question, as Jesus demonstrates. Well, let's take a second example from the Gospels. This time, we're going to go to Matthew chapter 22, where in a very famous story, again, that many of you probably know very, very well, Jesus is going to demonstrate how you can use a question to identify the real issue at hand. I'm going to read half the story, make a couple of comments, and then we'll read the remainder of it. So Matthew tells us the Pharisees went out and laid plans to trap Jesus in his words. They sent their disciples to him along with the Herodians. "Teacher," they said, "we know that you are a man of integrity and that you teach the way of God in accordance with the truth. You are not swayed by others because you pay no attention to them. Tell us then, what is your opinion? Is it right to pay the imperial tax to Caesar or not?" Now, of course, you're probably aware of the historical context here. First century Israel was an occupied land. The Romans were considered by most pious Jews to be evil occupying oppressors. And if you paid your taxes to the Romans, you were a collaborator and very much beyond the pale. On the other hand, if you didn't pay your taxes to the Romans, you were guilty of sedition and that you would likely face arrest, torture, and probably execution. So the Pharisees probably think this is a brilliant trap they have sprung on Jesus. A brilliant trap. Very dangerous trap, actually. It's so dangerous, have you noticed, they're too scared to ask it themselves. They send the Herodians and their disciples, which would have been young men aged maybe 12 or 13. Get the teenagers to ask the question while the Pharisees can leg it round the corner. And if the whole thing blows up, we weren't here, it wasn't ours, honest. And of course, they're thinking to themselves, we've got him. Because if he says yes, he's in trouble. If he says no, he's in trouble. Fantastic. We've got him with this one. So, of course, how does Jesus answer? Do you know, I so wish that Jesus had said, no, you shall not pay taxes. Because every time tax season comes round, we could write back to the CRA and say, I would love to pay my taxes. I really, really would. But Jesus said no. So I'm terribly, terribly sorry. But of course, if he'd said no, he'd have been arrested instantly by the authorities. If he'd said yes, then he'd have been morally compromised in the eyes of the audience. And here's what's going on here. This question is not about taxation. This question is actually a deeper issue. The question that really underlies the question here is, when is it okay to compromise morally? That's the question that Jesus is really dealing with. And so in that light, his answer is brilliant. Let me just read on in the story. But Jesus, knowing their evil intent, said to them, you hypocrites, why are you trying to trap me? Show me the coin used for paying the tax. They brought him a denarius, and he asked them, whose image is on this coin? And whose inscription? Caesar's, they replied. Then he said to them, well, give back to Caesar what is Caesar's, and to God what is God's. See, what Jesus does in this dialogue and using this question is he redefines the discussion here. He redefines the issue to basically say, it's okay to pay taxes when they're appropriate, but that's not the real issue. The real issue is about what we give to God. Do you know, I often wonder what would have happened if one of his audience had said, okay, teacher, okay, rabbi, okay, Jesus, you know, what belongs to God? Because I wonder if Jesus might then have said, well, whose image is on you? Now, let me use a contemporary illustration of how you or I might use a question like Jesus did to clarify the real issue at hand. Let's imagine that you are sitting in your favorite coffee shop. You're sitting in Tim Hortons. Or if you are considerably richer than I am, you're in Starbucks. And $6 for a latte, what's wrong with that? Now, you're sitting there drinking coffee with an old university acquaintance who happens to be in town. You haven't seen them for some years, and you're sitting there chatting, and suddenly, sort of out of nowhere, your friend looks at you and says, hey, of course, you're still into that Christianity thing, aren't you? You know, tell me, I've always wondered what Christians think about this. Is abortion wrong? You can hear all the other conversations in the coffee shop kind of die away. In fact, you can hear the squeaking sound of a dozen pairs of eyes sort of swiveling slightly on gimbals as people crane in to listen to this one. Now, what do you do? If you say yes, what's everybody going to think? Are people going to think, my word, what amazing wisdom has come from the lips of this Christian? I did not know that Christians were so wise and thought through and nuanced. You see, here's the problem. In the eyes of the world, in the eyes of your mind of your friend, what's this issue about? This issue is about choice, right? And what do we call people who restrict people's choice? We call them fascists, narrow-minded, dictators, oppressors, those kind of words. Not nice words. Now, of course, in the eyes of us as Christians, what's this issue all about? It's about something else entirely. So what about if we try to clarify the issue with a question? What about if you look at your friend and say, you know what, that's a really important question you've asked. You know, you've opened up a really deep ethical question here that we need to think through carefully. But to help us think it through, I wonder if I could, before I tell you what I think, if I could perhaps ask you a question. My question is this: when is it okay to take the life of an innocent person? Now, your friend is probably, unless you're having lunch with Pol Pot or something, going to say to you, well, it's never okay to take the life of an innocent person. Now, having established that, you can say, well, that's helpful. I'm glad we agree on this, because now we can have a substantive discussion. What is in the womb? Is it just a collection of cells, or is it an innocent life? In which case, we need to take seriously what you've just affirmed. But we've moved away from this whole emotive issue of choice and into the much substantive area of what is personhood and when does life begin. But if you miss that step, then anything else you say is going to be completely misunderstood and misconstrued. So using a question, just like Jesus did, you can clarify the issue, you can avoid some of the obvious pitfalls, and you can draw somebody into a conversation where they're much more willing to listen to you. You see, we live in a world, my friends, where there are questions about our faith come at us from all directions. You can see them in the media, on the lips of our friends, in the writing of skeptical writers and authors and bestsellers like Richard Dawkins' book, The God Delusion, that sold 6.5 million copies in the last few years. Questions are everywhere. And if we're going to talk about our faith with our friends, our neighbors, our colleagues, we can expect to run into objections and questions. And I really increasingly feel, the more I've been involved in talking to people out there in the public square about the Christian faith, that if we can learn to use questions rather than immediately feel we need to leap into giving a sermon download on somebody, we can be far more effective in answering many of the questions that we find on the lips of our friends, our colleagues, our classmates, and so forth. And in fact, there are, as I've engaged in these kind of conversations in universities and business settings across this country and elsewhere in the world, I've really come to realize there are really only three questions that we need to learn as Christians that we can that will help you deal with many of the objections and questions about our faith that come from different directions. Three questions I want to teach you in my last 10 minutes this evening that will stand you in good stead, I think, in many of these conversations. Three questions that you can take away this evening and practice, as Mary Jo encouraged you to also, as you engage in conversations with your friends. These are they. Three questions. And the question number one, what do you mean by that? Question number two, why do you think that? And question number three, have you ever wondered? Let me illustrate how those questions work by giving you some scenarios. Let's take the first question. What do you mean by that? Let's imagine that you're riding on the bus to work or college, wherever it is you go, Monday to Friday. And there you are, sitting on the bus, reading your big black Bible, as you always do on public transportation, just so everyone knows you're a Christian, and a really massive kind of one that needs wheels and things. When who should step onto the bus but an old school friend that you haven't seen for about 15 years? And your friend sits down next to you and goes, oh, my word, hello, I haven't seen you for years. Then seeing the Bible that you're reading, your friend goes, oh, you're not still into that religion rubbish, are you? God is a delusion for idiots. You know, no one believes in faith anymore. There's no evidence that God exists. There is no more proof for God than there is for Santa Claus or the Tooth Fairy. And you look at this and you think, this is why this person's an old friend, because they were like this 20 years ago. Now, you've got maybe 2 minutes to your stop when you're going to get off. There's probably other people listening to the conversation right now because everyone likes a bit of entertainment on the way to work in the morning. So what do you say? What do you say that it means you don't look like a dribbling right-wing religious nutjob or a lunatic? Something that perhaps responds to what your friend has said. What do you say? Well, if you think in your head, I need to give a five-minute lecture, you're in trouble. But what about if you use this question, the what do you mean by that question? What about if you were to say to your friend something like, well, it's interesting you say the word God. What do you mean by God? You see, not everyone has the same conception of God in their mind. Richard Dawkins, when he talks about God, he says he believes in a God who is a sort of a sky-dwelling, psycho-maniacal, genocidal, homicidal bully. Well, I don't believe in that kind of God, so we're not on the same page anyway. You could say to your friend, when you say delusional, help me understand what you mean. What precisely is delusional about believing in God? Or you might pick up on your friend's use of the word evidence and say, when you say the word evidence, what do you mean by that? What would count as evidence for you? What would you need to see in order to come to believe in faith in God? Any one of those questions might be really helpful and would lead to a discussion and a dialogue, and who knows, maybe an opportunity to follow up over coffee with your friend. It could take the whole heat out of the conversation. The what do you mean by that question is hugely important. Often people use words without thinking about what they mean. That's the what do you mean by that question. Secondly, we could do something similar with the why do you think that question. Let me illustrate with another scenario. Let's imagine this time you're at university. If you are a student here this evening, very easy to imagine this. If not, think back perhaps to your university days. And there you are, sitting at the back of the lecture hall in your university, and there on the desk in front of you, alongside your mug of coffee and your notebook and your laptop computer, you have, of course, your big black Bible that you always take with you to every university lecture, just so everyone knows you're a Christian. Nervous laughs. And your professor comes in, she starts her lecture. 2 minutes into the lecture, she looks up at the back of the lecture theatre and she sees your big black Bible, which is great, that's why you brought it, right? And she actually stops her lecture on feminist hermeneutics and Moby Dick or whatever it is she's lecturing on. And she says, "How dare you bring a Bible into a university classroom? The Bible is just a collection of myths and legends and fairy tales. It's a complete load of rubbish." And again, she just lets that hang in the air. Now, what do you do? You perhaps have maybe 30 seconds or a minute to respond if you're going to say anything. You don't want to look stupid. You don't want to make Christianity and God look bad. And this is also your professor. You don't want her to look stupid because she grades your papers. And there's also another very important principle. The woman with the microphone always wins. What about if you used a variation of the question that I'm illustrating here, the why do you think that? What if you simply asked your professor, "That's really interesting that you think that, professor. Tell me, why do you think that? What has led you to the conclusion that the Bible is a collection of myths and legends and fairy tales?" Now, at that point, one of two things will happen. Either your professor will have some reasons that she thinks this, and she will share them. And now you can engage with substance, either in the classroom or afterwards, or it will become very apparent to everyone listening and watching her flap around that she's just repeating a soundbite that she's heard from somebody else. Just because someone has a PhD doesn't mean everything they say is true. And simply by gently asking that question, you can expose whether there's any evidence there for what she's said, or if it's simply based on hearsay. Never be afraid to ask somebody why they believe the things that they do. And then lastly, three questions. What do you mean by that? Why do you think that? And thirdly, a question I love to use with people is, have you ever wondered? Have you ever wondered? Let me illustrate this one, actually, with a real-world example. Again, a year or so ago, I was speaking at McMaster University, just outside Toronto. And after my talk and after the Q&A, a young man came up to speak to me afterwards, looking sort of fairly sort of red in the face. So I thought, well, this would be interesting. You could sort of tell by the body language he wasn't an entirely happy individual. And without even saying hello or giving his name, he launched into, "Oh, I hate Christianity." I said to him, "Well, this is going to go well, but do carry on." Why? He said, "Well, because of the Bible. The Bible is homophobic, and it's anti-science, and it's anti-reason, it's anti-progress, it's anti-environment, it's anti-democracy, it's anti-women, anti-various words I hadn't heard of, actually, but, you know, I let him finish." And as he had his little rant, I was sitting there thinking, what do I say? Because, again, there were students gathered around, there was more than just one person now listening to this. And he finally came to the end of his little rant, and I thought, I wonder if I should have some fun with this. And I used a variation of the "have you ever wondered" question. And I looked at him and I said, "Just out of interest," I said, "why is it wrong to be anti-women?" He said, "What?" I said, "Well, you've listed that as one of the things that the Bible is anti. I've always wondered why that's important. Why is it wrong to be anti-women?" He went, well, it just is. I went, "Oh, come on." I said, you're a student at one of the top universities in the country. You can do better than that. He said, well, about 10 wells, actually, I got out of him. He went, I can't tell you, but it just is, it just is. I'd said, "What are you studying here?" He said, I'm training to be I'm a medical student. I'm hoping to be a doctor one day. I said, "Oh, interesting, what kind of doctor?" He said, I'm going to be a surgeon. I said, "Well, with every due respect, I put it to you that one day you'll be responsible for the lives and well-being of real human beings, not just university lecturers and things." And I said, "I really hope you can do better than the only reason I should treat people with respect is because I should. You need some real grounds for why you should treat people with dignity, irrespective of their gender or their race or their religion." I said, if you can't do better than simply it is because it is because it is. You see, here's the thing. I said, Christianity is not anti-women. The Bible's not anti-women. In fact, Christianity, I believe, gives the only basis for human dignity and for treating people with respect, no matter what their gender or whatever, that I know, because the Bible teaches that human beings are made in the image of God and bear incredible value and dignity. And with every due respect, unless you can find an alternative basis for treating people that way, then with all due respect, God help your patience. And it was interesting. He looked at me and he said, I've never thought about that before. You've really given me something to think about. And just by using a variation of that question, we went from angry and hostile to a young man walking out going, I really have to think about something more deeply. I've never explored why it is that I feel so passionately about that justice issue that he did. Questions are remarkably powerful things. And one final thing about questions and their power. I wonder if you've noticed that in one sense, the whole of the gospel hinges on our answer to a question. Have you noticed that? The gospel could be described in its simplest form as an invitation to answer a question. You see, in Mark chapter 8, verse 29, we have this famous encounter where Jesus turns to his disciples who have basically and asked them this question, you know, who do the crowds think that I am? And the disciples say, oh, you know, some of them think you're John the Baptist, some of them think you're Elijah, some of them think you're, you know, all kinds of things. Imagine the disciples kind of laughing. You know, there's one idiot in Cana of Galilee who thinks you're, you know, whoever, Moses or something. You know, Jesus, some of the crowds, they're doofuses, right? And then I think Jesus has a bit of fun with them. And then I like to think that Jesus looks at them, I like to think with a twinkle in his eye, and says, okay, what about you? Who do you say that I am? And it's interesting, isn't it? All the disciples go quiet, and only one man has the courage to answer the question. And that's when Simon Peter stands up and says, well, you know, you are the Messiah. You are the Christ. And Christianity, the gospel, hinges on our answer to that question. Because Jesus looks at each one of us. He looks at me, he looks at you, he looks at our skeptical friends, our friends in other religions. He looks at every human being. And every one of us will one day have to answer that question, who do you say that I am? And in fact, that question, in a sense, is what separates Christianity from every other religion or belief system on the planet. You see, every other religion or a system of thought or belief system on the planet is based or really on one of three ways. Every other religion out there is based either on a knowing or feeling or doing. Every other religion, many religions, for example, will tell you that the way to God, the way to paradise, the way to nirvana is through knowing the right things. That's Buddhism. You know, master the teachings of the Buddha and you'll achieve wisdom, a higher state of human living, a higher state of living or existence or whatever it is. Other religions are based on feeling. Many Eastern religions work this way. You know, if you have the right mystical experience, the right encounter with the divine, you can somehow work your way upwards and discover the meaning of life. And then there are religions based on doing, like Islam, that say that if you keep the commandments, if you work hard enough, if you're good enough and moral enough and holy enough and upright enough, then perhaps you can work your way upwards to heaven. Christianity is the only exception. Because Christianity cuts right through those three things and says, it's not by what we know, by what we feel, or by what we do, that we can climb our way upwards or claw our way upwards to heaven. Because the gap between us and God is too great. Rather, we have to let God bridge that gap between heaven and us from his side, and he's done it in Jesus Christ. And in Christianity, the issue is not what you know, what you feel, or what you've done, but who you've met. And whether you've encountered God himself come in the flesh, in the person of Jesus Christ. You see, Christianity is unique in that it's a short response to a question asked by a person. Jesus, who do you say that I am? Now, a couple of years ago, I was here in Vancouver for an event we were holding at RZAM. And we had a wonderful week here at one of our summer schools. And I was out one evening halfway through this conference we were at. I was sitting outside drinking coffee. I'd kind of skipped out of the evening session. My brain was overloaded. And I was sitting drinking coffee outside the university when a gentleman came up and sat down next to me and said, Andy, can I join you for a moment? And I looked at him and I realized it was one of the sound engineers who'd been doing sound for our conference. And I said, oh, yeah, do join me. And he said, have you got a few moments? I said, sure, I have. He said, I need to begin by telling you something. He said, I'm not a Christian. I said, okay. Go on. He said, well, I used to be, but I'm not anymore. So I said, well, tell me what happened. What happened? He said, well, I was raised in a very, very conservative household, very, very rigid conservative household, conservative church, where all questions were forbidden. As a young man, I had questions, but every time I tried to ask a question, I was slapped down. I was told by my pastor that even asking questions will send you to hell. My father once slapped me for asking a question about God at the dinner table. And he said, eventually, I got to 18 or 19, and I left home, I had enough. I jacked the whole thing in. I threw out Christianity. I wanted nothing more to do with such rigid fundamentalism. And I became an atheist, and I wanted to find other like-minded people, so I joined a local atheist group. And it was full of people a bit like me, actually, who'd had religious upbringings and rejected it. And it was great for a few months. And then he said, I discovered something. I discovered those atheists that I'd ended up with were as fundamentalist as the Christians I'd left. Because if you questioned their favorite authors or their pet theories or whatever it was, you got slapped down or told you were an idiot or laughed at. And I said, and in the end, I left that group. And now I don't know where I am. I don't know where I fit. What do I do? What do I do? And I remember sort of thinking, wow, I've had some questions in my time, but you know, what do you respond to somebody like that, who feels that he doesn't fit anywhere because he has questions that nobody's willing to take seriously? And as I reflected on it and sort of prayed, thinking, what do I need to do here? I thought, you know what? I was reminded of something I just shared with you. That the heart of the gospel is about a response to a person. So I said, tell me, what do you think of Jesus these days? And I forget his exact answer, but it was words to the effect of, I miss him. And I said, I wonder whether, you know, it sounds like at one point in your life, for all of its faults, you know, you were on that road with Jesus, and then something went wrong, and you sort of went, tumbling off into the undergrowth and the bushes, and now you feel you're lost in the middle of nowhere. I said, I just wonder whether it's possible for you to kind of back up that trail one step at a time. I'm not encouraging you to go straight back into church and immerse yourself in Christianity, but perhaps you could take a couple of steps back towards the Jesus that you say that you miss. You know, I encourage you, would you be willing to perhaps sit down and open the Gospels and start rereading them in your own time and at your own speed? And if you're interested in that, I said, I can put you in contact with some friends here in Vancouver who would love to do that with you and let you ask any questions that you want. He said, I would love to do that. And we were able to put him in touch with one of the pastors here in the city that we know well. You see, ultimately, our answer to any questions, to any of our skeptical friends, to any objections that we encounter, really has to lead people back to Jesus Christ. Apologetics is not about winning arguments or proving we're clever or showing that we've read the right books and have all of the answers in our brains and ready to download. Using questions cleverly like I've shown you or some of the stuff that Mary Jo's shown you, again, isn't about trying to defeat our skeptical friends in the game of intellectual chess. Aha! You may think you've got a question, but I have a better question. Ultimately, it's about bringing people into an encounter with Jesus Christ, the one who is the ultimate answer to all of our questions and to whom we want to lead all of our friends. And it's my prayer for each one of you this evening that you will have the joy and the excitement of seeing him use you to bring your friends, your neighbors, your colleagues into that living encounter with him. And if you're here tonight as someone who doesn't yet know that relationship with Jesus, who hasn't yet answered that question, who do you say that I am? I encourage you to think about taking that step this evening. Thank you for listening so patiently.